Salve et grata ismas et schismata podcast. That was Latin, obviously. You knew that, it was perfect pronunciation. And thank you for joining me for another episode where I try to demystify theological jargon, and I try to make it a little bit of fun along the way. In this episode, we are looking at neither an ism nor a schism, but a phrase you may have heard. I think if you've been around the Christian world long enough, you've probably heard this mentioned. It's also something you'll learn pretty much on day one if you go to seminary. But it's one of those phrases that a lot of people will just assume you know and might look upon you with pity if you dare ask, "Excuse me, I don't speak a dead language, so what did you just say? And what does this mean?" Well, I am here so you don't have to ask that question. But you should never be afraid of asking questions. Never. If you have a question, ask it. In this episode, we're exploring and unpacking the Latin phrase imago Dei, which essentially means image of God. And so this phrase is used when discussing the creation and nature of humanity. Pull up a chair, pull out a mirror, grab your Latin dictionary, and let's get into it. To my ear, the phrase imago Dei sounds a little bit like a fancy Spanish aperitif. Or is that French? I don't know. But I can imagine someone ordering an imago Dei with extra olives, por favor. Ooh la la. Okay, well, wherever you are, let's hop across to Italy, where they used to speak Latin and the phrase imago Dei meant image of God, which, if we are now to hop across to ancient Canaan, comes from the Hebrew Bible. In Genesis chapter 1, God said, "Let us make humans in our image, according to our likeness." So God created humans in his image. In the image of God, he created them, male and female, he created them. In Hebrew, imago Dei is Betzelem Elohim. And this claim that humans were created in the image and likeness of God is a deep and rich theological notion. What does it mean that humans are made in the image of God? Basically, in my simplified version, it means we are God's mini-me's. We are made to reflect God and to bear his good characteristics. Of course, an image is not exactly the same thing, but the image of that thing. In the same way that my photo of Westminster Abbey is not the Abbey, but is an image of the Abbey. Also, if you visit Westminster Abbey, don't take a photo inside the building, because I did and I got told off. It's a good photo though. But a photo or an image is always from a single, particular perspective. And I think the beauty of the diversity of humanity is that we are all different images of God. We show a different perspective of God. Just like your photo of Westminster Abbey will be different from mine. But it's the same Abbey, and the two images give us a bigger picture of what the Abbey is like. The imago Dei reminds us of several things about humanity. The first has to do with humanity's ability to think, to be rational and intelligent. God is a God of order and structure, and creation reflects that. We see it in the world around us. We are not surrounded by chaos, but rather there are rules that govern the cosmos, and we are able to interpret that and understand that. We have minds that are able to figure things out and to think logically. Second, humanity is thoroughly relational. We need other people. We need one another. We have an inbuilt need to seek companionship, build relationships, and live in community. In fact, if we don't get that, we can feel lonely. Or being isolated can become really bad for us. Just a quick note, if you need companionship, reach out. I'm hoping we can build a community here, and I'd like to be your friend. If we are the image of God, we are the image of a Trinity, a God who is in perpetual and eternal relationship. I did an episode on the Trinity, so you can go back and listen to that. Just do that after this episode. But being in the image of that God means that we are relational. We need one another, and we can and should be here for one another. Third, just as God is a creative God, we too are creative beings. We need to create. We like art and nice-looking and nice-sounding things. We like to imagine and daydream. We like to read and write. We build, we solve problems, we think critically, and come up with creative solutions. If God creates, so do we. Fourth, we are moral beings. We have this inherent sense of morality. Of course, this does change depending on our historical and cultural context, but at our core, we just have a sense that some things are right and some things are wrong. A lot of that could have evolved with humanity as a sort of defense mechanism to protect the community at large, but that nevertheless reflects the nature of God and is something we draw from God. Fifth, I think it also speaks to the dignity of humanity and life in general. According to Genesis 1 and to this notion of Imago Dei, humans are not an accident and they are not an afterthought. God intentionally imbued humanity with something of himself. Genesis chapter 9 includes a prohibition of murder on the basis that all humans are an image of God. To murder another is basically to murder God. Again, this does not mean that we are God. And of course, the issue of sin complicates this a little bit, but I really think it gives dignity to human life. But while we're thinking about creation and humanity, I would like to explore the idea of creation being a temple and humanity being priests within that temple. The ancient Near East was approximately 1,000 to 3,000 years BCE, and even earlier, roughly the area encompassing the lands known today as Turkey to the north, Egypt to the south, and Iran to the east. These lands went by various names and different kingdoms rose and fell, but include the great states of Babylonia, Assyria, Anatolia, the Hittites, Egypt, Samaria, Crete, and a bunch of others. It was within this area that the early Hebrews lived and where their traditions developed until they were collated and written down in the Hebrew Bible, or the Old Testament. Yeah, that's great, Aaron. Well done. Who cares? We should care because what's interesting is that we find a lot of ancient Near East custom and mythology reflected in various parts of the Hebrew Bible, not least being the first 11 chapters of Genesis. One custom in particular is the consecration of Sumerian temples. Sumer, located in modern-day Iraq, is one of the oldest civilizations in the world, as in invented the wheel and the first written language system, old. After constructing these temples, the big ones are called ziggurats, there would be a ceremony that lasted 7 days. In these Sumerian, as well as other ancient Near East temple consecration and ongoing annual ceremonies, each day of this consecration would focus on and celebrate a different part of that particular deity's power, which could be a part of the world, particularly looking up and seeing the sun and the moon and the stars. Sumer was one of the first civilizations, after all, to engage in astronomy. Some of the zodiacs traced all the way back to the Sumerian and Babylonian times, including Gemini and the division of the sky into 12 signs, reflecting the lunar calendar. So there you go. Each day would celebrate part of the natural world, including humanity and the consecration of priests who would serve the deity. And then eventually, on the last day, the god would be invited into the temple, which was where the god lived. The god would reside or rest within the temple on that 7th day. Sometimes the presence of that god would be symbolized by an object of some sort, an idol. And that idol would be the image of God to all who visit or work in that temple. So you can probably already see the parallels between this temple consecration and the creation account in Genesis 1. God creates the world, and each day reflects the creation of a different part of that world, including the sun and moon and stars. And then animals and then humans are created, and humans are said to bear the image of God, and they are placed in that creation. And then on that last day, God rests. It means that the purpose of creation and the creation of humanity was to serve as God's temple, his residing place, and humans serve God, taking on priestly duties, like Adam did, who was charged with caring for creation. From all of that, we can then tell that humans were created to care for God's temple, his creation, this world around us, and that being made in the image of God, we represent God in this world. We are his idol, if you like. There are no idols in the Jewish religion, and in fact there are strong repudiations of idol worship. The prohibition to construct a graven image is even in the Ten Commandments. And that's because humans are that idol, that icon, that image of God. It was also a way for the Hebrews to make sense of these other religions, presenting them as a parody of their own, that these other gods get a physical temple, albeit a pretty big, pretty cool-looking temple. Our God, Yahweh, gets the whole world as his temple.
Whoa!
And where you worship an idol made of wood or rock, our God is a living and active God, represented by not just some statue, but humanity itself, living and active. Then along comes Jesus, who is, according to the New Testament, the ultimate image of God. The author of the Epistle to the Colossians says he is the image of the invisible God. And the author of Hebrews says he is the radiance of the glory of God and the exact imprint of his nature. The Gospel of John records Jesus as saying, "Whoever has seen me has seen the Father." So what that means, according to so much European art, is that God looks like an old white dude with perfect blonde hair, bright blue eyes, and a torso as chiseled as his jawline. Probably not. First, that's a very Eurocentric image. And second, Imago Dei does not mean that God looks like us in terms of a physical body and whatnot. What it does mean is that Jesus is the expression of the ideal human, the sort of human that we should strive to be like, the sort of human that perhaps we might look like in the next eschatological age. But it also demonstrates Jesus' divinity. He is God, and so he looks just like God. Where we are images of God in the sense of one of my scribbles of a napkin that I've spilled a little bit of coffee onto, Jesus is a Rembrandt or a Monet or maybe even a Salvador Dali, because he's a little bit mysterious and surprising.
Well, that's no surprise at all.
And if Jesus wants to melt a clock, he can melt a clock. We reflect God's character and likeness imperfectly. Jesus reflects it ultimately. One final point about Imago Dei is how this notion has been used for social justice causes. Christians who have fought for the rights of women, children, people of different ethnicities, of different classes, and other similar causes have adopted the argument that people are the image of God. All people are the image of God. And so they have rights, and they should be treated equally. Each individual person should be treated as an emissary of God himself. In the 4th century, Gregory of Nyssa used this very argument against slavery. He questioned, "What did you find in existence worth as much as this human nature? What price did you put on rationality? How many coins did you reckon the equivalent of the likeness of God? How many coins did you get for selling the being shaped by God?" For Gregory, slavery was the ultimate blasphemy, because it put a price on the image of God. This doctrine gives us pause, causes us to reflect on ourselves and on our neighbors. Jesus said we should love our neighbors as we love ourselves. Why? Because we each bear the image of God. Thank you for listening to another episode of Isms and Schisms, and I hope this one was interesting and enjoyable. As always, rate, review, subscribe, share, all of that. Check out the website and Instagram and get in touch. Let me know what you think and if there are any topics you would like me to explore. This episode was recorded on the traditional lands of the Whadjuk Noongar people. I look forward to exploring more isms and schisms with you.